Welcome to Sleepy Time Travels. We embark each week from the century-old portal of public domain treasures. Folktales, mystic wisdom, spiritual evolution. These forgotten texts are the perfect balm for your fevered brain, soothing it away from whatever ridiculousness the day has wrought. This episode's trail toward the land of Nod is the opening section of Tales from Ariosto, as retold by a lady, originally published in 1880. Knights, chivalry, sorcerers, it has it all. So, adjust your pillow, breathe deep and easy, and listen to the story of the Princess Angelica.
The Adventures of Angelica in the Forest. The story I am going to tell you took place in the days of the great Emperor Charlemagne, when the Moors, under their young king Agramante, crossed the sea from Africa in order to invade France and to revenge the slaughter of Trajano, their king's father. The famous paladin Orlando had long been enamored of the beautiful Princess Angelica, and had, for her sake, encountered great perils and adventures in the distant countries of India, Media, and Tartary. He had just returned with her to Europe, in time to join the mighty army which Charlemagne had collected at the foot of the Pyrenees, and to take part in the battle in which the emperor hoped to punish Agramante and his ally Marsilio, king of Spain, for their audacity in bringing over the Moors and Spaniards to devastate the fair realm of France. Here, however, Orlando met with a most unexpected misfortune. The beautiful lady, whom he had in safety escorted through so many and various dangers, in the long journey from the far distant isles of the Hesperides, was now taken from him, not by an enemy's sword, but by the decree of the emperor, who, being displeased at a quarrel which had broken out between Orlando and his cousin Rinaldo, on account of their rival pretensions to the favor of this fair princess, had appointed the Duke of Bavaria her guardian, with the promise that whichever knight should most distinguish himself in the approaching battle should obtain her hand as the reward of his valor. The expected victory, however, turned out a disastrous defeat. The Christians fled before the Moors. The Duke of Bavaria was taken prisoner, and his camp fell into the hands of the enemy. Angelica foresaw, early in the day, that the fortune of war would turn against the Christians, so, mounting her horse, she left the field and entered a great forest, where she soon afterwards met a knight in complete armor, his sword by his side and his buckler on his arm, coming in great haste towards her, along a very narrow path. No timid girl could have started from a venomous snake with greater horror than Angelica at the sight of Count Rinaldo, the Lord of Montalbano, who, having by some strange mischance lost his famous horse, Bayardo, was now in search of him. He also, lifting his eyes to her fair face, at once recognized the beautiful countenance which held him captive in the chains of love. When Angelica saw him, she trembled and became deadly pale, and hastily turning her horse's head, she plunged into the very thickest of the forest, paying little attention in her headlong flight as to which of the many intricate and winding paths she took, until she reached the banks of a river, where stood the Saracen knight, Ferrau. He had come here after the battle was over, wearied with fighting and parched with thirst. And while bending over the brink of the stream to drink, his helmet had fallen into the water, and he was now occupied in trying to recover it. Startled by the damsel's loud cries for help, he rushed up the bank, and in spite of her agitation, and of the time which had gone by since he had last seen her, he knew her directly. He, no less than the two cousins, was filled with admiration for her wondrous beauty. He therefore courteously offered her his aid, and, all unhelmeted as he was, drew his sword and hastened to attack Rinaldo, who had followed her, and whom he knew well by sight, having often fought with him before. Then began a fierce combat between these two well-matched warriors. Thick and fast fell the mighty blows, but as swiftly and as skillfully were they parried, until Rinaldo, seeing that the princess had disappeared, said to the pagan, "If it is for the sake of the shining orbs of that new-risen planet you detain me here, will it much serve you to take me dead or alive, since, while we thus delay, the lady has escaped? Were it not better to go in search of her, and when we have captured her, then to allow the fortune of war to decide whose the fair prize shall be?" This proposal pleased the Saracen so well that, forgetting their recent dispute, he invited Rinaldo to mount up behind him, and they galloped off in pursuit of Angelica. So loyal and gentle were the mariners of those old times, that in the hearts of these rivals, in love and enemies, in religion, there lurked not the slightest suspicion of each other's good faith. They came at length to where two ways met, and as the prints of horses' hooves were equally fresh upon both, it was decided that Rinaldo should take one road, and Ferrau the other. That which the Saracen took wound in and out of the wood until it brought him back to the place where he had started. So, finding he had lost all trace of the beautiful lady, he set about trying to recover his helmet, which was deeply embedded in the sand at the bottom of the river. While he was endeavoring to loosen it with a long pole, there suddenly rose from the midst of the waters the form of a knight of fierce aspect. His head was bare, but otherwise he was fully armed, and he held in his hand the very helmet which Ferrau was seeking to regain. "Ah, faithless knave," he wrathfully exclaimed, "have you forgotten Argalia, Angelica's brother, and that, when you slew me, you promised to throw this helmet with the rest of my armor after me into the river? Lament not that the fates have restored it to me, but rather lament your own perfidy. And if you wish to replace it with one as precious, take the helmet of Almonte from Orlando, or that of Mambrino from Rinaldo, and leave me in peace with mine." When the Saracen saw the shade of Argalia appear, so unexpectedly, in the middle of the river, he grew pale with horror, and his hair stood on end. At the reproach of broken faith, his heart sank with shame and remorse, and he solemnly vowed that henceforth no helmet should cover his head but that which Orlando had once taken in Aspromonte from the fierce Almonte, an oath which he kept better than his promise to Argalia. Then, sorrowful and ill at ease, he set out in search of Orlando. In the meantime, Angelica rode fast and recklessly through the dark forest, fancying in the rustling of every oak or beech leaf she heard the footsteps, in every shadow she saw the form of Rinaldo. As some poor timid fawn, which is seeing its dam rent in pieces by the savage leopard, flies from copse to copse for shelter, and brushing through the thick branches, imagines itself to be caught in the very jaws of the ravenous beast, so rode the lady all that day and night, little heeding whether her path led her, until, on the afternoon of the next day, she found herself in a beautiful little valley surrounded by lofty trees, whose leaves were softly fanned by the fresh air, and where two bright streams kept the rich grass evergreen and gently breaking over pebbles and low rocks, maintained a constant harmony of sweet sounds. Here, thinking herself safe, and many miles away from Rinaldo, tired with her long ride, and exhausted by the heat, she determined to take some rest. She accordingly got off of her palfrey, and, unfastening its bridle, suffered it to feed at large on the abundant pasture which the banks of these clear rivers afforded. Close by, she saw a thicket of flowering thorns and crimson roses overhanging the water, in which they were reflected, and defended from the rays of the sun by high and spreading oak trees. In a green glade of softest grass, in the midst of this bower of roses, which was so thickly twined that neither the sun nor mortal eyes could penetrate it, Angelica lay down and soon fell fast asleep. It was not long, however, before the sound of horses' hooves awoke her, whereupon, rising quietly, she looked through the bushes and saw a knight in armor who had dismounted from his horse and was now lying beside the stream, resting his cheek on his hand, and so absorbed in thought, and so still that he might have been taken for a statue. She was uncertain whether this would prove to be a friend or an enemy, and her heart beating with alternate hope and fear. She awaited the end of the adventure, scarcely daring to breathe for fear her retreat should be discovered. For a long time the melancholy knight remained in the same posture, and at last began in plaintive tones to lament his hard fate as follows. "Ah, why do I waste my affection on one who scarce bestows a thought on me, one who grudges me even a look or a smile, while upon others she lavishes tokens of her favor? Ah, unkind fate, why must I languish in despair, while others rejoice in triumph? Yet, when I try to banish the remembrance of this cruel beauty from my heart, I feel I would rather die than cease to love her." Sighs interrupted his complaint, and rivers of tears ran down his cheeks, a sight to have melted the hardest heart. He paused for a little, then sang this sorrowful ditty. "Ah, lovely rose, so proud and fair, blooming upon thy thorny stem, so fresh and gay in morning air, sparkling with many a dewdrop gem. Thou'rt formed some beauty's brow to grace, entwined amid her clustering hair, or find still a sweeter place to blush upon her bosom fair. Alas, when plucked, how soon to fade, to wither and be cast aside, like some forlorn, forsaken maid who once was bright in virgin pride. If any ask who thus wept by that river's bank, you must know it was Sacripante, king of Circassia. And the cause of all his grief was love for the beautiful lady who was now listening to him. In India he had heard, to his great dismay, that she had accompanied Orlando to Europe, and for her sake he had now come from the far east to the lands of the setting sun. When he arrived in France, he learned that the emperor had taken her from Orlando and had promised her hand as a prize to the knight who should best serve the cause of the golden lilies in the great battle against the Moors. Having joined the camp of Agramante, he had witnessed the defeat of Charlemagne, and was again pursuing his quest of Angelica. The princess, who had soon recognized her old lover, listened attentively to his lament, but with no intention of taking pity upon him, for colder and harder than any stone, she treated all her admirers with equal disdain, and believed no one to be worthy of her. Now, however, finding herself alone and friendless in these wild woods, she determined to take him for her guide, knowing that he who was up to the chin in water had better cry mercy, and that she let this opportunity slip, she might not again find so trustworthy a champion. For the king had long ago proved himself the most faithful of all her friends. She advanced from her concealment within the shady thicket, a sudden and beautiful apparition, as Diana or Venus of old might have appeared from some dark grove or gloomy cavern. With what wonder and delight did Sacripante behold the angelic countenance, the fair and graceful form, standing so unexpectedly before him. He ran towards her with open arms, and the sight of him, recalling to her mind her native country, and her father's palace, with some sudden vague hope of perhaps soon again seeing that beloved home, she embraced him with greater tenderness than she had ever shown to Orlando. She then related to him at length all that had happened to her since she had last seen him, and told him how often Orlando had saved her from death and defended her in danger. While thus conversing together, they were startled by a loud noise, which seemed to come from the neighboring wood. And the king, whose habit was to go about fully armed, put on his helmet, and, replacing the bridle, mounted his horse and held his lance at rest. Scarcely had he done so, when there rode towards them out of the wood a knight of proud and valiant bearing. He was habited entirely in white, and a snowy plume formed the crest of his helmet. Sacripante, angry at this unwelcome interruption to his pleasant discourse with Angelica, gave him furious and disdainful glances, and, when he came near enough, defied him to single combat, boasting that he would with ease hurl him from the saddle. But the stranger knight, who thought no whit less highly of himself, cut short these arrogant menaces by spurring on his charger and raising his lance. Sacripante attacked with like fury, and the two riding full tilt at each other, their shields were pierced through at the same moment. It was well for both that their stout breastplates stood them in good stead and resisted the blow. So do two lions or two bulls hurl themselves at each other, making the very hills resound with the thunder of their onslaught. The horses met with such force that the one belonging to the pagan fell dead with his full weight upon his prostrate rider. The other fell also, but at the touch of the spur rose up again. And the stranger knight, after gazing for a few moments upon his vanquished foe, not caring apparently to renew the contest, rode off at full gallop through the forest, and was miles away before the Saracen had disengaged himself from his dangerous position. As the stunned and stupefied herdsman, when the thunderbolt which struck him down by his slain oxen has passed, rises and gazes in astonishment at the pine tree, whose lofty summit he had so often admired. Now shorn of its great branches and all its leaves, thus did the pagan slowly and with difficulty rise to his feet, and see Angelica standing near him and looking down upon his discomfiture. Silent and crestfallen, he stood before his fair mistress, his cheeks crimsoning with mortification, and groaning as much for shame as for the pain of his bruised and shaken limbs. For not only had Angelica seen his fall, but with her own soft hands she had helped to free him from the weight of his dying horse. "Ah, my lord," said she, "let not your fall distress you. It was caused indeed, not by your fault, but by that of your poor horse, who stood in need of food and of repose, rather than of fresh combats. Nor has yon knight much more cause to boast, if, as I have always understood, he who first abandons the field acknowledges himself vanquished." While the lady was thus consoling the Saracen, there came galloping by, with horn and pouch slung at his side, a courier, who asked if they had seen the knight of the white shield and snowy plume pass by that way. Sacripante replied, "It is he who, as you may perceive, has worsted me in battle, and even now ridden away. And that I may know who is my conqueror, I pray you tell me his name." "In that will I soon satisfy you," said the courier. "Bradamante is the famous name of the gentle damsel, who, valiant as she is beautiful, has dismounted you and deprived you of your well-earned honors." So saying, he hurried on, leaving the poor Saracen more than ever burning with shame and vexation. For a while, he stood thinking over his late misfortune. Then, silent and abashed, he mounted Angelica's horse and signed her to get up behind him, far too sad at heart to continue his former conversation with her. They had gone scarcely 2 miles when the woods through which they were riding resounded with a strange and fearful noise, and there rushed out a mighty war horse, magnificently caparisoned with rich gold-embroidered trappings. As he approached, vaulting over the streams and trampling down the bushes and shrubs that impeded his course, the princess said, if the thick underwood and the deepening twilight do not deceive me. That charger, plunging through the forest with such uproar, is Bayardo. If it is indeed Bayardo, I know him well, and he has come at the right moment to do us good service, for our horse will soon weary under his double burden. The Circassian dismounted, but vain were all his attempts to catch hold of the charger's rein. Whenever he approached him, Bayardo turned round and round, quicker than lightning, and flung out his heels. Presently, however, he went up of his own accord to the princess, with the gentle fawning of a favorite spaniel, who joyfully greets his master on his return home. Bayardo, indeed, remembered her well, for she had often petted him in old days in Abraca, when she had much loved his master, the then obdurate and ungrateful Rinaldo. She caught hold of his bridle with her left hand, while with the other she stroked his glossy neck. And the horse, under her familiar touch, became as gentle as a lamb. Sacripante jumped quickly on his back and gathered up the reins, while Angelica seated herself again in her own saddle. She had scarcely done so when, lifting her eyes, she saw a tall knight, fully armed, coming towards her, and with terror and abhorrence, she recognized Rinaldo, the Duke Amon's son. He now loved her more than life itself, but she hated and fled from him as the crane flies from the falcon. Once upon a time, she had cared for him as much as he disliked her, but a wonderful change had been wrought in their feelings towards each other by the waters of two fountains in the Ardennes. Not far apart, but very different in their effects, one causing the heart to overflow with love, the other turning all former love to bitter hatred. Rinaldo tasted of the first, and was filled with admiration and affection for Angelica, while she drank of the waters of the other, and at once all her love for him changed to abhorrence. Thus it happened that, when she saw him, she changed color, the light faded from her eyes, and with trembling lips and faltering accents, she begged Sacripante not to await his approach, but to escape with her as quickly as possible. "Am I then," said the Saracen, "fallen so low in your estimation that you think I am no longer able to defend you? In old days, in Abraca, you had more confidence in me. Do you forget how often I there fought successfully in your behalf?" The princess made no answer, and scarcely heard what he said, for Rinaldo had come near enough to recognize his warhorse, and also the angelic face whose beauty he so much admired, and now began to shout forth threats and imprecations against the Saracen. Angelica meets with a hermit and is carried away to an island in the Western Ocean. Of most disastrous chances, of moving accidents by flood and field, of hair-breadth scapes. Shakespeare. Ah, perfidious love, why does it delight thee to sow discord between loving hearts? Why make Angelica so beautiful in the eyes of Rinaldo, while he was so hateful in hers? Time was when she thought him nobleness itself, but he then despised her as she now despises him. "Scoundrel, dismount," Rinaldo haughtily called out. "Give up my horse, as well as this fair princess. To allow so noble a charger, so perfect a lady, to remain in the possession of so poor a knave, were a disgrace to my chivalry." "Thou liest," returned the Saracen no less haughtily. "No knave am I. He who should call thee so might, as I have heard, do it with some justice. However, it shall soon be seen who best deserves both horse and lady. For there I agree with you, that so fair a princess is not to be found all the world over." Without further parley, the king of Circassia and the knight of Aspromonte drew their swords and advanced to the assault, with shouts of fury and defiance. It was of no advantage to the former that he was mounted, for Bayardo refused to attack his master, and neither with spur nor blow could be induced to move a step. When urged to advance, he stood stock still. When to stand firm, he trotted and cantered forward, or, putting down his head between his forefeet, plunged and kicked, until the Saracen, finding it was but lost time to try and master the restive animal, placed his hand on the saddle bow, and, with a light bound, jumped to the ground. Then indeed there began on foot a worthy trial of arms between this valiant pair. The blows of Vulcan in his dusky cave, when he forged the thunderbolts of Jove, fell neither so fast nor so hard as those of these masters in the noble art. Now they bend low, then rise to their full height, now cover themselves with their shields, then uncover for a little space, now advance, then retreat, now redouble their strokes and swing their swords swiftly round their heads. Where one yields, if but an inch, the other instantly places his foot. At last, Rinaldo lifted high his good sword, Fusberta, and hurled it down with all his force on Sacripante, whose great shield it cut straight through. The forest groaned with the shock, and the fine ivory and well-tempered steel flew asunder like brittle ice. When the princess saw the consequences of this tremendous stroke, her face grew white with fear, and not daring to linger, lest she should fall into the hands of the detested Rinaldo, she turned her horse's bridle and urged him up a steep and narrow path through the dense forest, often looking back to see whether he were following her. After riding for some time, she entered a valley where she met a venerable-looking hermit riding upon an ass. His white beard fell low on his breast, and his gentle face, wasted with age and fasting, seemed to look with pity on the terrified and agitated lady. She asked him to show her the shortest road to some seaport, for her great wish was to leave France and to get away from the sound of Rinaldo's hated name. The pretended friar, for he was in reality an old necromancer, comforted her and told her he would soon put her in the way of safety. He rode beside her for some time, finding great pleasure in her society. But she at length grew tired of his slow pace, and, bidding him farewell, she rode on and left him. After traveling for some days alone, she reached the coast of Gascony, but she little knew that the wicked old necromancer, angry at her desertion, and determined to punish her for it, had summoned one of his malicious imps, and had ordered him to follow her and to incite her horse to work her some mischief. So it happened that, in spite of all her efforts to prevent him, the animal walked straight into the sea, and it was of no use that she lifted up her dress and even her feet upon the saddle, so as not to get them wet through, for he soon got out of his depth and began to swim. Her golden hair floated loose upon her shoulders, and, as if entranced at the sight of such great beauty, the winds and the waves lay perfectly still and calm before her. In vain she turned her weeping eyes towards the land. Farther and farther it receded from her, and fainter grew its outline. At last, after swimming a long distance, the horse turned to the right, and landed, just as night began, on a solitary part of the shore, surrounded by high rocks and gloomy caverns. When she found herself alone in this deserted place, the aspect of which caused her mortal terror, and saw Phoebus about to sink below the ocean, and to leave the world to darkness, with disheveled hair and clasped hands, she stood for some moments so motionless that it might have been doubted whether she were a living and breathing woman, or some sculptured marble. Then, raising her wearied eyes to heaven, she burst into tears and exclaimed, "Ah, cruel fortune, when wilt thou cease to persecute and torment me? It were far kinder to have allowed me to perish beneath these waves than to have rescued me, only to expose me to greater misery. Banished from my royal home, driven over the wide world, a helpless and hopeless wanderer, I have nothing left me but my youth and this far-famed beauty, which, whether deserving of its renown or not, has been the cause of all my misfortunes. For its sake did my brother, Argalia, in spite of his magic weapons, lose his life. For its sake also was my father, Galifron, the great Khan of Cathay, slain in India by Agrocaine, the king of Tartary. Deprived of my dominions, my friends, and my home, for what greater evil dost thou preserve me? If the sea were too easy a grave, send, I beseech thee, some savage beast to devour me, and so end my sufferings. Thus did Angelica pour forth her sorrows, until, worn out with weeping and fatigue, she sank down on the sands and fell into a deep sleep. And now I must leave Angelica for a while and tell you about an island in the northern seas, to the west of Ireland, called Ibuda, which was but very thinly inhabited, since Proteus had sent Orca and all his sea monsters to devastate it. There was an old tradition, whether it be true or false I cannot say, that once upon a time a powerful king ruled there, who had an only daughter of such rare beauty that the sea god, Proteus, seeing her one day walking by the seashore, fell in love with her and persuaded her to marry him. After a time, the king, her father, found this out and was so furiously angry that he ordered her head to be cut off on the spot. Proteus, when he heard of the sad fate of his beautiful bride, determined to avenge her, and therefore sent a large army of sea lions and bears and the marine monsters which Neptune had put under his rule to destroy not only the flocks and herds in the island, but the towns and villages with their inhabitants. After they had done this, they surrounded and set siege to the capital, in which all that were left of the people had taken refuge. Within these walls, the natives defended themselves for many days and nights with great courage, until, worn out with privation and fatigue, they determined to go to the temple and consult the oracle as to what they should do in this dire necessity. The answer was that they must find out a maiden equal in beauty to the princess they had beheaded, and expose her on the seashore as an offering to the angry sea deity, in exchange for the wife he had lost. If she should seem to Proteus sufficiently beautiful, he would cease to molest them or their country. But if not, they must go on offering him one victim after another until he were satisfied. Thus began the cruel custom by which so many lovely damsels were sacrificed to Proteus. For as day by day he rejected them, a huge orca or sea monster, who remained behind in the harbor after the rest of the hideous tribe had departed, swallowed them up alive. Whether all this story about Proteus be fable or not, I cannot tell. But certain it is that in this island the horrible custom existed of daily feeding this sea monster with a young and beautiful maiden. Women in all countries are subject to hardship and trial, but here indeed was their lot deserving of pity. The unhappy maidens, whom adverse winds or their unlucky star brought them near the island, were captured and kept for these sacrifices. And this means not sufficing, expeditions were fitted out to seek for these poor victims in distant countries. Many fair damsels were thus captured, enticed with deceitful promises, or bought with gold, and conveyed in barks and galleys to fill the dungeons of their castles and fortresses. It came to pass that one of their galleys, happening to sail by the place where Angelica lay asleep, the sailors landed to take in wood and fresh water, and there discovered this pearl of perfect beauty. Alas, too precious, too exquisite a prey for so barbarous a people. Ah, cruel fate, can it be that you will deliver to that savage monster the rare beauty for whose sake Sacripante sacrificed his glory and his great kingdom, for whom the mighty Orlando tarnished his fame and wasted his noble gifts? Can it be that she, whose beauty turned the heads of half the East, is now so abandoned by all that there is not one to speak a single word in her behalf? The sailors bound the beautiful princess while she was still asleep and carried her off to their ship to join the wretched band of captives already there. As soon as they reached the island, they placed her in the keep of the citadel to await the fatal day when the lot should fall upon her. Perhaps her angelic face touched the hearts of these savages, for they kept her there many days. At last, however, her turn came, and followed by a pitying and weeping crowd, she was led forth to the monster. Who can describe her despair? Her cries and tears must have reached the ears of heaven itself. Why did not the earth open and conceal her in its depths, and so save her from the terrible death which awaited her? The fierce tiger of the East, the ravening lion of the desert, might have wept with pity at the sight of this fair princess bound to the cold and naked rock. What, then, would have been the feelings of Orlando, or of the two knights we left fighting for her in the forest, had they known her sorrowful plight? How willingly would they have dared 1,000 deaths to rescue their beloved lady from such infinite peril? How Angelica was rescued from the sea monster and met Orlando. That snaky-headed gorgon shield that wise Minerva wore, unconquered virgin, wherewith she freezed her foes to congealed stone. Milton. By good chance it happened that the famous knight, Ugiero, riding on his wonderful winged horse, Hippogriff, was passing through the air on his way from Ireland to Brittany. And when he came above the Island of Tears, for so was the country inhabited by this barbarous and inhuman people called, he chanced to look down and saw Angelica chained to the bare rock, waiting to be devoured by the orca. Ugiero at first thought some beautiful statue, hewn in marble or purest alabaster, had been placed on the shore, till the tears which rained down her cheeks and the golden tresses of her hair, which the breeze gently lifted, undeceived him. As he looked into her lovely eyes, he was reminded of his own fair Bradamante, and was so overcome with pity that he could scarcely refrain from weeping. Checking his steed in his rapid flight, he thus addressed her. O lady, worthy of that chain alone with which love leads captive his servants, and most undeserving of this or any other evil fate, who has been so barbarous as to bind and wound the pure ivory of those fair hands? Tears were at first the lady's only answer, and when she tried, in a voice broken with sobs, to speak, a fearful noise in the direction of the sea caused her to stop short. The huge monster, appearing half below and half above the waters, like some great vessel driven by favoring winds towards the wished-for port, was seen approaching and preparing to devour the fair morsel set forth for him. But a short space divided him from poor Angelica, and she had given up all hope of deliverance, when Ugiero raised his lance and struck the huge, shapeless mass between the eyes. For the creature could not be said to have any form, with the exception of his head, which, with prominent eyes and protruding tusks, somewhat resembled that of a hog. The blow fell as if on iron or steel, and as the orca, leaving his sure prey on shore, furiously pursued the great moving shadow on the water, cast by the outspread wings of the hippogriff, Ugiero continued to aim blow after blow with sword and spear, but all in vain, for they only resounded back from the rough, hard scales, as if from jasper. So an eagle swooped down on a serpent gliding through the grass, or basking on the bare rock, its smooth and gilded skin glittering in the sun. And so also, in hot July, with its golden harvests, in dusty August, or in Vintageladon September, an impudent fly buzzes round and annoys some great mastiff, who with empty teeth snaps at it again and again, but all to no purpose. The monster in his fury lashed the ocean with his tail, till the very heavens were darkened with clouds of water, and the horse's wings were so drenched that Yujiro scarcely knew whether he was flying or swimming, and longed for the help of a boat, for fear they should become so heavy as to be useless. Casting over in his mind to what means he should have recourse, he all at once bethought him of his enchanted shield, and straightway flew to the rock and placed the magic ring on the little finger of the princess's right hand, partly that it might not hinder the effect of the shield upon the orca, partly that it might defend her own eyes from its baneful influence. For its wondrous property was to render all enchantments vain. How Yujiro became possessed of the famous winged horse, the enchanted shield, and the magic ring, I shall hope to tell you in the story of Yujiro and Bradamante. When the monster, covering half the sea with his huge bulk, again approached the shore, Yujiro stood ready and raised the shield. He suddenly uncovered it, and it seemed as if a second sun had blazed forth in the heavens. The meoic rays struck the eyes of the great beast, and dazzled and blinded by their exceeding brightness, he sank down in the foaming waves, even as a stone drops into the depths of some troubled mountain stream. Before Yujiro could reach him with his lance, he had disappeared, and the princess begged him to waste no more strength nor time on the scaly beast. "For God's sake, my lord," she cried, "hasten to undo these chains before the orca recovers from his trance. Carry me away, and rather drown me in the ocean than allow me to remain here a prey to this hideous monster." Yujiro, moved by her distress, unbound the lady, and, placing her behind him, took her away from that fatal shore on his flying steed, which, after lightly pawing the ground with his feet, spread his wings and sped swiftly through the air to the nearest point on the coast of Brittany. There, Ruggiero and the princess alighted on a green meadow, watered by a fountain in its midst, which, lying between two high mountains and bordered by a grove of spreading oak trees, the haunt of innumerable nightingales, offered them a cool and pleasant retreat from the heat of the midday sun. Yujiro could not help gazing with wonder and curiosity at the face whose exceeding beauty had filled the whole world with its fame. And when Angelica cast down her eyes from his admiring glance, she caught sight of her own precious ring, the magic ring which Brunello had stolen from her in Abraca, and which she had brought with her on her first journey into France with her brother Argalia, when he carried thither the golden lance, which afterwards fell to the lot of Astolfo the paladin. Many dangers had she escaped with the help of this ring, and from the day she lost it, fortune had never ceased to be unfriendly to her, until it had driven her into banishment, an exile from her own kingdom. When she beheld it on her own finger again, she was so overcome with astonishment and delight that she could scarcely believe her senses. She took it off very gently, cautiously conveyed it to her mouth, and, like a flash of lightning, or rather as the sun when hidden by a cloud, she disappeared from before the eyes of Yujiro. He looked around him in utter astonishment and stared as one in a trance, until he suddenly remembered the ring, when his surprise changed to anger. First at his own carelessness in leaving it with Angelica, and then at her ingratitude and at the discourtesy with which she had repaid his kindness. "Ungrateful lady," he exclaimed, "is this my reward? Will you rather carry off my ring than receive it from me as a gift? Why not accept it from me, and with it my shield, my steed, and all I have? Do what you will with it, but do not, I beseech you, hide from me your lovely countenance. For I know, O cruel one, that you hear, though you will not answer me." Thus lamenting, he wandered around the fountain, often like some blind man, stretching out his arms to catch the fair damsel, and as often embracing an empty shadow. The princess, in the meanwhile, went on her way, nor stopped until she came to a large cavern, in which, to her great joy, she found some food, of which she stood much in need. In this grotto there dwelt an old peasant, who had the charge of a herd of horses, which fed on the fresh green grass that grew on the low pasture ground along the banks of the river. On each side of the cave were stalls, in which the herd took shelter during the sultry hours of noon, and in one of these Angelica rested all that day. Towards evening, when she was sufficiently refreshed, and the air had become pleasantly cool, she rose and put on some coarse garments she found lying about, very different from the gay vesture of many varied fashions and bright hues, green, yellow, gray, blue, and pink, to which she was accustomed. Yet this humble raiment could not so disguise her as to make her appear aught but a most noble lady and lovely lady, to whom none of those so famed by the ancients, neither Phyllis, nor Amaryllis, nor Galatea, could compare in beauty. She chose from among the herd the palfrey which appeared best fitted for her use, and mounting it, started on her journey. She thought her best plan would be to try and make her way back to her own beautiful kingdom in the east. Only she somewhat wished that either Orlando or Sacripante could accompany her. Not that she cared for one more than the other. Indeed, all her many lovers were equally indifferent to her. But foreseeing that on her way to India she must pass by many cities and castles, she felt she had need of a companion and guide, and knew she could find none more trustworthy. She traveled far without finding any trace of them, until, after having sought for them fruitlessly in cities and villages, through great forests, and on many different roads, fortune at last led her to the castle where Orlando, Sacripante, and Ferrau were held bound in strange enchantments by the famous magician Atlante, and with them Ugiero and Gradasso, and many others, as you shall hear more particularly when I come to the history of these knights. She entered the enchanted castle, and making herself, by virtue of her ring, invisible even to the magician himself, she searched it in all directions until she found Orlando and Sacripante together, both pursuing an empty shadow in her likeness, by which Atlante had allured them to the castle, and by which he still kept them there. Between these two knights, she was puzzled which to choose. Whether would the Count or the Circassian King serve her best? Orlando might, with greater valor, defend her in perils and dangers by the way, but she knew that if she accepted him as her guide, she must also take him for her lord. He could not be got rid of and sent back to France when she grew tired of him. Whereas, for this occasion, however highly she might favor him at first, she thought she would find no great difficulty in dismissing him afterwards. And for this reason, she decided upon trusting herself to his zeal and affection, and making him her companion for as long as she had need of him. She therefore took the ring out of her mouth and raised her veil, thinking to show herself only to Sacripante. But it chanced that Orlando and Ferrau saw her also, and as now that Angelica had put the ring on her finger, all the magic arts of Atlante were dispelled. The three knights mounted their horses, and rode in pursuit of the golden hair, the dark eyes, and blooming cheeks of the beautiful princess, who, not caring to be accompanied by three such devoted lovers, had urged her palfrey to flight. As soon as she had led them sufficiently far from the castle to render them safe from the machinations of the sorcerer, she again placed the ring between her rosy lips and vanished from their sight. At the same time, she abandoned her intention of asking either Orlando or Sacripante to return with her to her kingdom of Galafema in the far-off east. For she suddenly took a dislike to both and determined to trust herself alone to the all-sufficient protection of her magic ring. The forsaken knights, like blind and dizzy fools, turned their amazed eyes, now to one side of the wood, now to the other. So do hounds when the wolf or the hare they are following in the chase suddenly burrows into some hole or furrow, and the scent is lost. The haughty Angelica, meanwhile, laughed to herself as, unseen, she watched their movements. There lay but one path before them through the forest, and they saw no outlet by which she could have escaped them. Therefore, supposing that, after all, she must be in front, Orlando galloped on, with Ferrau at his heels, and Sacripante spurring on behind, while Angelica followed at a more moderate pace. When they came to where several paths diverged and lost themselves in the thicket, they began to look for the prints of her horse's hooves on the grass. And Ferrau, who among the proudest might well be said to hold his head highest, turned defiantly to the other two and cried, "Wherefore do you follow me? Retrace your steps, or choose some other road, unless indeed you are prepared to lose your lives by my hand. Think not I brook rivals either in the pursuit or in the favor of this fair lady." Orlando replied, no less haughtily, "Villain, saw I not that thy helmet was lacking, I would soon make thee learn whether such words were well or ill spoken. Why shouldst thou concern thyself with that which troubles not me?" answered the Spaniard. "All helmetless as I am, I fear not to hold my words good against ye both." "I pray thee," said Orlando, turning to Sacripante, "lend the fellow thy helmet, that I may cure him of this folly, the like of which I have never seen." "Who would then be the greater fool?" replied the king. "But if it seem a fair request, I pray thee lend him thine, for I, forsooth, am no less apt at the punishing of a fool than thou." "Fools are ye both," cried Ferrau. "Think ye, had it pleased me to wear a helmet, that one of you would not, ere this, have been bareheaded? But to let you somewhat into my confidence, no, I go, and shall go thus until I get possession of that noble and famous helmet which the paladin Orlando now wears." "Then," said the count with a smile, "wilt thou, bareheaded, pretend to do to Orlando that which he did in Aspromonte to Almonte? I believe, didst thou but see him face to face, thou wouldst tremble from head to foot, and rather than try to deprive him of his helmet, wouldst gladly agree to give him up every bit of armor thou hast upon thee." The vaunting Spaniard thereupon answered, "Often and often have I this same Orlando so hardly pressed that I could, with ease, have taken from him his arms as well as his helmet. And if I refrained, it was because, at that time, I cared but little for them. Now, however, I desire this helmet, and I hope soon to succeed in obtaining it." At this, the count could no longer keep patience, and exclaimed, "O liar, O foul Moor, in what land? Where and when canst thou boast of having overcome me in battle? No, I am that paladin Orlando of whom thou pratest, thinking him far enough away. Come, try and win my helmet, and think not I will take thee at disadvantage." So saying, he unfastened his helmet and hung it up on the branch of a beech tree close by. At the same moment, drawing of his crude sword, Durindana, Ferrau, however, did not lose heart, but drew his sword also, and with it and his raised shield to guard it, his uncovered head. Wheeling round their horses, they advanced to the fierce encounter, endeavoring to strike each other between the joints of the harness or on the weaker parts of their armor. In all the world, no two warriors could have been found so equally matched in skill, in strength, and in valor. Fast and furiously did the battle rage. Ferrau aimed not a blow in vain, and each stroke that Orlando let fall broke the plated steel, or burst asunder the linked mail. Angelica looked on unseen, the sole spectator of this fearful fight. For the king of Circassia, thinking she was still in advance, when he saw Orlando and Ferrau fairly engaged in combat, had ridden on, following the path which he supposed the princess to have taken. She stood for some time watching the encounter, which seemed to her fraught with equal peril to both. At last, from mere curiosity to see what the knights would do when they missed the helmet, she determined to carry it off, intending to return it to the count as soon as she had sufficiently amused herself with playing him this trick. She took it down very gently, and after watching them a little longer, she quietly went on her way and had gone some distance before the theft was discovered by either of the two angry knights. Ferrau was the first to find it out, and, starting back, he cried, "Ah, see, how has that knight, our companion, befooled and betrayed us? What prize can now reward the victor, since he has stolen the precious helmet?" Orlando turned and looked, and when he saw the helmet was no longer hanging on the bough, he was almost beside himself with rage. He also supposed that the knight who had gone on in front had carried it off, and turning his rein, put spurs to Brigliadoro, and galloped off in pursuit of him. Ferrau followed closely at his heels, until they came to a place where they saw fresh footprints on the grass, made by the horses of the Circassian and the princess. Orlando took the path to the left, down the valley, whither Sacripante had gone, while Ferrau went up the mountain by the ascent which Angelica had followed. She, in the meanwhile, had arrived at a pleasantly situated fountain, which invited all who passed by to taste of its sweet waters, and to rest near its cool and shady brink. Angelica thought she would take some repose by this clear brook, not deeming that any one could overtake her, and feeling, moreover, safe from all unforeseen peril under the protection of her magic ring. She hung the helmet on a bush near the grassy bank of the shining stream, and was just about to fasten up her horse's bridle so that he might feed on the rich pasture, when the Spanish knight, having followed her horse's tracks, reached the fountain. Angelica no sooner saw him than she put the ring into her mouth and disappeared, and forgetting in her haste to pick up the helmet, which had fallen on the grass, she urged her horse to flight. When the Spaniard caught sight of her, he rushed towards her with great delight, but, as I have said before, she vanished like some phantom at the awakening from a dream. And search as he would, his sorrowful eye beheld her no more. Cursing all magicians, sorcerers, and their magic arts, Ferrau turned back towards the brook, and there, behold, on the grass before him, lay the helmet of Orlando. He recognized it at once, even before he read the words inscribed upon it, which told how Orlando had obtained it, and when, and where, and from whom he had taken it. However much disappointed at the disappearance of Angelica, who had vanished as a shade of the night, the pagan did not neglect to pick up the helmet and to put it on his head, and when he had securely buckled it, seeing that nothing was now wanting to complete his happiness but to find this lady, so continuously vanishing from and reappearing before his eyes, like flashes of lightning, he set out to seek for her in every direction, up and down the wide forest. At last he was obliged to give up all hopes of finding her, and he started to return to the camp of the Spanish king before Paris, his grief at the loss of the princess being lessened by the satisfaction he felt in having fulfilled his vow and in wearing the helmet of Orlando. How Cupid takes his revenge upon the haughty Angelica. Come live with me and be my love, and we will all the pleasures prove that hills and valleys, dale and field, and all the craggy mountains yield. There we will sit upon the rocks and see the shepherds feed their flocks by shallow rivers, to whose falls melodious birds sing madrigals. See Marlowe. Angelica, invisible and alone, continued her journey with a troubled brow, for she was vexed at having, in her needless haste, left the helmet by the fountain. Owing to my foolish whim, and to my meddling with that which was no concern of mine, she said to herself, I have lost the Count his helmet, and have made him but a sorry return for his many and great services to me. With only good intentions, and heaven knows I speak truth, though the event has turned out so disastrously, I took it, thinking that so perhaps a truce might be put to their battle. Not indeed that, through my help, that hateful Spaniard should obtain his wish. Thus regretting that she had carried off Orlando's helmet, sorrowful and ill at ease, she took what she supposed to be the most direct road to the east. She generally traveled invisible, but sometimes, and on fitting occasions, she allowed herself to be seen. She had gone through many provinces of France, when one day she entered a wood, and came upon a youth wounded, and pierced through the breast by a lance, lying beside two companions who were already dead. He was a young Moor named Medoro, whose story was a very touching one, and as an example of faithful and disinterested affection, worthy of being related. Medoro and his friend Cloridano had come into France in the train of their beloved lord and master, Dardanello, whom they had followed in good and evil fortune, until he had met his death in a battle recently fought near Paris, in which the Saracens had been defeated by the Christians under Charlemagne, and driven back in confusion to their camp, leaving their dead unburied on the held. The night after the battle, the two friends kept guard together on the entrenchments, discoursing, sadly enough, upon the events of the day. And Medoro, more especially, thinking about his beloved master, and lamenting that his body should be left unhonored and uncared for, out on the plain. He was a youth of a most charming and beautiful countenance, admired by all for his fine dark eyes and curly golden hair, and of a disposition as sweet and engaging as his face. Turning to Cloridano, he said, I cannot tell thee how it grieves me to think that the precious body of my lord lies out there, a prey to the wolves and to the ravens. Remembering how kind and good he always was, it seems to me that even if I lost my life in doing honor to his memory, I should but pay back a very small part of the debt of gratitude I owe him. I will, therefore, if possible, make my way unobserved through the camp of Charlemagne, and seek for my lord's body, that it may no longer lie there without honorable sepulchre. Do thou remain here, and should death be my fate, tell in what cause I found it. Cloridano was surprised to find such love and devotion in the heart of this young boy, and at first tried to dissuade him from so perilous an adventure. But Medoro would not listen to him. He said he was determined to give his lord an honorable burial, or to die in the attempt. Cloridano, who had been a hunter, and was a strong and active man, said that he could not suffer a friend he loved so dearly to go alone upon this glorious enterprise, and that rather than be left alone in the world without him, he would go and die with him. They therefore sallied forth together, and after many dangers and many hairbreadth escapes, they made their way in safety through the Christian camp and reached the plain on the other side. Here, a scene of horrible carnage met their eyes. The bodies of men and horses, kings, nobles, squires, and footmen, lay bathed in blood, heaped up in dire confusion among broken lances, swords, shields, and bows and arrows. The two friends might have wandered about in their vain search over the battlefield until the day dawned, had not the kind moon suddenly burst forth from behind a dark cloud, clear and lovely as when she once shone upon the adoring Endymion, and lighted up the scene. The city of Paris and the two hostile camps lay outspread in her bright rays, with the undulating plain beyond, and the hills of Montmartre and Valerian in the distance, while at their feet they saw distinctly in the clear pale light the lifeless body of Dardanello. Maduro recognized him at once by his white and crimson shield, and kneeling down beside him, he bathed his dear face with bitter tears. Then sadly and very quietly, lest they should be disturbed by the enemy, the two took up the corpse of their king and bore him away between them as quickly as the weight of their precious burden would allow. By this time, the Lord of Light, who chases darkness from the earth and blots out the stars in heaven, began to appear and betrayed the two friends to Zerbino, a Christian captain, who, after chasing the flying Moors all night, was returning with his troop to Charlemagne's camp. No man knows how he is really loved when borne aloft on the prosperous wheel of fortune. True and feigned friends then keep together at his side with equal show of outward devotion. But when evil days come, the flattering crowd turn upon their heel, and only true and faithful heart, who, like Maduro, love in life, in death, and even after death, remain. When Cloridano saw the horsemen, he said quickly, "Brother, we must put down our burden and take to our heel. It would scarcely be acting like prudent men to risk losing our two lives for this one lifeless body." So saying, he let go his hold and fled, thinking Maduro was following him. But he, poor boy, loved his lord too well to abandon him. So taking the whole weight upon his shoulders, he made for a wood hard by, hoping to conceal himself in its thickets. It was, however, so overgrown with tangled underwood, and was such a labyrinth of narrow, intricate paths, that only wild animals could have made their way through it, and, impeded by his heavy burden, and unable to find a road, he could make little progress, and was soon overtaken by his pursuers. In the meanwhile, Cloridano, hearing no footsteps behind him, looked round, and, not seeing Maduro, he immediately repented of having left him. For what would life be worth without his friend? He, therefore, retraced his steps, and, taking one of the narrow winding paths into the wood, he was soon led by the sound of arms, horses, and threatening voices to where Maduro, alone and on foot, was defending himself against a whole troop of horsemen. He had placed his sacred charge upon the ground, and stood over it with his back against a beech tree, making the best stand he could against such fearful odds. So the bear, whom the alpine hunter has tracked to her rocky lair, stands before her cubs, roaring with mingled rage and fear. Anger and native ferocity urge her to put forth her claws and quench her thirst for blood. But in the midst of her fury, love softens and draws her back to keep guard over her young. Cloridano, not seeing what help he could give in joining his friend against so many, drew his bow and sent an arrow among the assailants, which killed a young Scotch squire. And when they all turned round to see whence the unexpected attack came, he let fly another with as fatal effect. Zerbino, the Christian captain, upon seeing this, lost all patience, and seized Maduro by his golden hair. But when he looked into his soft eyes and fair young face, he was touched with pity, and could not find it in his heart to slay him. Maduro thereupon besought his compassion in the following words. "Sir, I pray you be not so cruel as to deny me leave to bury the body of my king. I ask no other boon, for I care not for life, and when I have paid the last honors to my beloved master, you are welcome to throw this poor carcass to the ravening beasts and to the carrion birds." He spoke with such moving accents that Zerbino was filled with pity. But one of his troopers, coming up at that moment, plunged his spear into the poor youth's breast, and he fell, apparently lifeless, to the earth. Cloridano, when he saw him fall, rushed out upon the Christians with his sword drawn. But he also was soon overpowered and stretched dead beside his friend. Maduro lay for some time unconscious, his life's blood ebbing away fast through his open wound, when, just in time to save him, unlooked-for help appeared. A damsel approached him in the humble attire of a shepherdess, but of most noble appearance and exceeding beauty, with manners as courteous as they were dignified. I need say no more, for you must have guessed that this was Angelica, the royal daughter of the great Khan of Cathay, who, since she had regained possession of her ring, had grown so proud and so haughty that she held the whole world in scorn. She journeyed quite alone, and disdaining the company of even the most renowned knights among her former friends, scarcely deigned to remember that she had once called Orlando and Sacripante by that title, and despised herself for having ever cast her eyes with favor on Rinaldo. But lo, Cupid, angry at having been so long set at defiance, now fixed the arrow in his bow and placed himself in ambush near the spot where Maduro lay. When Angelica saw the youth, who, lying at the point of death, sorrowed more for his unburied king than for his own evil case, unwonted pity touched her heart, which softened with emotion such as she had never before felt, when, in broken accents, he related to her his sorrowful story, recalling to mind her knowledge of the art of surgery, which she had learnt in the Indies, for in those countries this is looked upon as a great and noble science, handed down by father to son, without much study of parchments. She set about preparing a balsam from the juice of certain herbs, with which to heal his wound. She remembered having seen on her way a plant growing in the meadows. I know not if it were didymus or woundwort, which was of singular virtue in staunching wounds and in relieving acute and deadly pain. She went back and gathered it, and meeting on her return to the wood a shepherd riding in search of a heifer, which 2 days before had strayed from his herd, she took him with her to where Maduro lay, so bathed in blood that but a faint spark of life remained. Angelica alighted from her palfrey, and having bruised the herb between two stones, she collected the juice in her white hands and poured it into the wound, at the same time applying the balsam to his breast and limbs. The remedy was of such sovereign power that it not only stopped the flow of blood, but so restored his failing strength that he was soon able to sit up and to be placed upon the shepherd's horse. Not, however, before he had seen the body of his king laid under the earth, and Cloridano placed in the same grave, did he permit himself to be led to the humble abode of the friendly shepherd, who dwelt with his wife and children in a clean and pretty cottage he had but lately built, sheltered by low-lying hills and pleasantly situated at the edge of the wood. Angelica determined not to leave the wounded youth until he was quite restored to health, and tenderly she nursed him, until by degrees his handsome features and his gentle manners transformed the pity she had felt for him, from the moment she had first seen him lying wounded on the ground, into a still softer passion. The wound of Maduro soon healed under the skillful tending of the lady, but the wound made in her heart by the arrow of the winged and unseen archer only grew deeper and more poignant. As he regained health and spirits, she became gentler and sadder, till at length overcome by the dread of having to part from him, she laid aside all her native pride and confessed to him her love. O Count Orlando, O King Sacripante, of what avail were all your high achievements, your noble birth, your great renown? What reward did all your faithful services obtain? Could you point to one act of favor shown to you at any time by this fair princess, in gratitude for all you encountered for her sake? How would it have enraged you and Ferrau and many others, whom I do not name, who dared a thousand deaths in this ungrateful lady's service, could you have seen her love bestowed, unsolicited, upon this unknown youth? Under the auspices of the shepherd's good wife, the wedding of Angelica and Modoro took place with all holy and fitting ceremonies, and with as much festivity as the simple household could afford. They stayed on with their kind hosts for some weeks, Angelica never tiring of the society of her dear Modoro. And he as devoted a lover as the most exacting princess could desire. Hand in hand, they wandered through the green meadows and pleasant valleys, or rested in some cool grot, where Modoro would carve verses on the smooth rock to celebrate his lady's beauty and his own happiness, or spent the sultry noontide hours in shady groves, where they would amuse themselves by cutting their names and initials, interlaced in many curious and intricate devices on the trees. Of all her rich and costly ornaments, Angelica had only preserved one, a massive gold bracelet studded with gems, which Orlando had once given her, and which she valued so much for its great beauty that she never suffered it to quit her arm, and had managed to keep it even when exposed to the orca by the barbarous people on the Isle of Tears. This she now unclasped, and when bidding farewell to the kind shepherd and his wife, she begged them to accept it, and to keep it for her sake, as a token of her gratitude for all their goodness to her. She then continued her journey with Modoro. Crossing the Pyrenees into Spain, they went to Barcelona, where they found a vessel about to sail for the Levant, in which they took their passage and had a prosperous voyage to the east. Soon afterwards, Angelica had the happiness of being received with joy by her people, and of presenting to them the amiable and beloved Modoro as the chosen partner of her throne. And thus ended in peace and happiness the many adventures of the beautiful Princess Angelica.
If perchance you're still awake and would like to hear more of this story, you can find it on Audible and elsewhere. The Kindle and paperback you can also get from Amazon.